Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. So yeah, so I'm joining you here from British Columbia. Unfortunately, I couldn't travel for this workshop, although I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. I have my hands full at the moment because my family has a newborn baby. And yeah, so the best compromise was to give the talk virtually. And with the, you know, additional information that actually I grew up in Waterloo, I have a lot of family in Waterloo. So a collaboration with people in Waterloo, you know, could make a lot of sense for me. So this talk today that I'm going to give, it's rather different from the talks given today, the earlier two talks given today, because it's an experimental talk. And it's also a talk not on actual real materials, but rather on a synthetic material that's made using nanoscale lithographic devices. So this is actually a picture of the device that I'm going to talk about a little bit later. So the sort of take-home message of the talk, it comes actually in the first slide. And that's basically the following. So we have many different types of programmable quantum systems in the laboratory. And two of the most advanced are trapped ions and superconducting based devices. And here, you know, already a few years back, we had examples of 40 to 50 qubit systems. So we have two level systems in these engineered trap ions and superconducting chips. This one is in a vacuum, and this one is literally pieces of superconductor on a chip. And you know, we've come very far with these devices. And if I was to summarize the difference in the platform that I will describe today, it's that it's a few years behind. We've only recently reached 6 qubits. But the thing that's interesting about it is that the type of element that we have available to us to play with is different. So in a trapped ion, it's this spin of a particle, and we don't have access to a charge degree of freedom. In a superconducting chip, it's a lossless anharmonic oscillator. My group actually works on superconducting devices, but I won't talk about it today. And these are rather large objects. Roughly a millimeter squared pitch or a millimeter pitch between the elements. So the two things that really distinguish these spin qubits is one, that it's a spinful fermion, the element that we have control over. It's a smaller number of elements. They have exceptionally long coherence times, and that's something that I will talk about. And that's always an advantage when you want to build a programmable quantum system. And then the last one is that the qubit area itself is substantially below 1 micron squared. And that is actually related to one of the challenges of scaling this system, because we need to rely on more advanced kind of fabrication technologies. So I'm going to be talking about the column on the right in this talk. And the key idea there, I have two sketches, one looking from the side on a wafer and one looking from the top on a wafer, which is a scanning electron micrograph. And basically how this system works is that we can confine individual carriers within a material. And we do that artificially by having a set of metallic gates on top of the device on which we can apply voltages and consequently shape the potential landscape and trap individual, let's say, electrons or carriers of the material. And we do this only by building this device, putting it inside of a cryostat, and applying voltages onto these gates. So let's show you here. This is the left plunger, and underneath it goes one particle, one hole, or one electron. Here's the right plunger, and underneath it goes one electron or hole. So the proposal for spin-based quantum computation with quantum dots is now a rather old proposal. And there's been significant recent progress in this area, some of which I will highlight. So to take it a little step further, I want to tell you really the basic elements of this system. The first aspect is that let's say that we can produce this potential using our gates, right? Then it's like a pocket. It can store a number of electrons in orbitals. The first thing that we try to do is we bring it to a very low temperature where the scale of the thermal fluctuations is much below the scale of the higher orbital excitation. So let's say this is the ground state, then we have an excited state, one or two excited states there, well, many excited states, and that the gap to those excited states is delta S, and we cool to temperatures well below delta S. That's relatively easy to do. So, and that corresponds to, you know, temperature of order of 10 to 100 millikelvin is more than enough. That's a standard dilution refrigerator. The second thing that we can do is we can freeze out electron number fluctuations. So, you know, we can add another electron to this pocket. And doing so, because of the mutual Coulomb repulsion, there's an addition energy associated with that. And those could be like, say, on the scale of 5 to 15 milliEV. And that's also easy to freeze out. So it's not unlike a trapped ion. We need to, well, conceptually, we need to freeze out these other degrees of freedom. And once we do that, we can apply a magnetic field and produce a two-level quantum system. And the interesting thing about these kind of quantum systems from a physics point of view is that they take the properties of the solid host. So for example, they may live in the conduction band, and this is the example here of, this is a silicon's electronic structure. It has six degenerate conduction band minima and two degenerate valence band maxima. And, you know, if it's a conduction band electron, then it will have predominantly a spin 1/2 character. And if it's a valence band hole, which will be the topic of this talk, then it will be really a spin 3/2, but still a time reversed system. The other thing besides the band is the bath. So the bath gives the system its coherence properties. You know, it will couple to our quantum system that we want to control carefully. And that would include things like a nuclear spin bath or phonons. And, you know, those will be different in different materials. So the first thing I want to highlight is recent idea that has emerged in this community, which is to use a quantum dot array as an analog fermionic simulator. And this idea is actually not very different from what you might want to do with cold atoms, for example, in an optical lattice, but they exist in very different types of space for the properties of the quantum system. So the similarities are that they're spin half particles on a lattice. We have also control over tunnel couplings and energy levels, but we accomplish this by tuning voltages applied on the gates. And so let's say if I take this system, it has three quantum dots in it, I can map this onto a extended Hubbard model. And you know, we can control the tunnel coupling and energy levels dynamically. And then at the time of the fabrication is when the Coulomb repulsion and nearest neighbor Coulomb repulsion get defined. It actually, you can't really widely tune those like you can in cold atoms. And then the other thing that we have is that our on-site energies are always repulsive. We don't have control over attractive and repulsive interactions like in the cold atom community. However, what we do have, one of the major advantages are things like the ability to prepare pure states. And it's much simpler to prepare a pure state in a system like this, because these tunnel couplings, instead of being on the order of like, you know, a few tens of hertz, they're on the order of 200 gigahertz or 10 gigahertz. And that's, we can go to temperatures far lower than this. So that's basically the system as an analog simulator. And let me show you an example of a recent work that has been done. So, and this system on the left-hand side, what we have is four quantum dots here, the blue regions that I tried to highlight. Those are regions where by applying voltages onto the yellow gates in this picture, we've isolated four different sites, and we can control the number of charges on those sites and the tunnel couplings between them. And if you insert one hole onto the system or add one electron, then depending on the amount of tunnel coupling between those four sites, you can get a ferromagnetic ground state here. And that was, it was demonstrated by a group in Delft that they could tune from this ferromagnetic state to the anti-ferromagnetic state simply by tuning a voltage on voltages on these gates, right? So instead of having to dope the material, produce two different materials, I can have control over this Hamiltonian at just by adjusting voltages on gates. And that's really the idea. So in particular, what they showed is by going from this closed ring to an open 1D system, so that the 1D, periodic boundary condition 1D system to open boundaries, going from the ferromagnetic state, which is purple, to the the anti-ferromagnetic state, which is purple here, to the ferromagnetic state, which is orange. And that occurs because the opening of this link suppresses the interference processes that lower this ferromagnetic ground state. And so if we were to look at and try to compare against cold atoms, you could say, well, one of our advantages is that we have pure state initialization. A clear disadvantage is that we're not talking about lattices with 100,000 atoms, or let's say 80 atoms even yet. It's a small system. The system is currently being developed and scaled. But another interesting thing that we have the ability to do, which is very challenging in the cold atom community, is to have also a set of digital logic gates, that turns out to be challenging for cold atoms. Okay, so let me talk about that aspect, the digital control. So we can also think about these quantum dots as conventional qubits. And what kind of qubits are those? So one aspect of them is that they're very clean spin qubits. Coherence times above 10 milliseconds, even approaching seconds, have been routinely demonstrated. And the idea behind that is that the spin is easy to isolate from the environment first, but second, this nuclear bath of spins, IK, which you can see are all these little arrows in the material here, they can actually be completely eliminated by isotope purifying the material. So an example would be silicon 28, which has no net nuclear spin, and we can produce crystals now since around 2015 of this kind of material to obtain these, very long coherence times up to a second, kind of almost as if it's a trapped ion, but not quite. Okay. The other thing we have, for example, is high fidelity single qubit gates. So they can be performed by the spin resonance. So in this picture on the right hand side, we have oscillating current going through this antenna. It produces an oscillating AC magnetic field, and that can be used to control this spin, like similar to NMR from the 1950s, right? It's just very simple physics to get complete control over the qubit. We also recently have demonstrations of 99+% fidelity two qubit gates. The mechanism is actually the tunnel coupling between the two sites. That's the underlying physical mechanism, which is an isotropic Heisenberg exchange, because this system has this isotropic spin interactions. And they can be performed relatively fast, very fast compared to the coherence times. And this is an emerging area. We don't exactly know yet what limits the fidelity, but what we know is, it's important, of course, to be able to demonstrate high fidelity. Similarly, high fidelity measurement on a timescale of around 1 microsecond has been demonstrated. And that actually the technique used to do this is very similar to this in the superconducting community, which is the use of a superconducting resonator and the spin-dependent or qubit state-dependent modification of the resonance frequency and quality factor of that resonator. So the example here, you have 1, 2, 3 quantum dots, And the sensor dot allows you to sense relative motion of the one electron from one site to another. That is a spin-dependent process because of the exchange Pauli exclusion principle. And that allows you to do a readout in the single triplet basis. And so the result is either this bright state when the spin can't move because the cavity is not loaded, or the dark state when the spin does move, that charge motion damps the cavity. Okay. So to sum up, I think the question that I'm very interested in and what we're starting to work towards with experiments in my lab at UBC is to think about a hybrid of the analog and digital approach with quantum dots. So in other words, can we combine the fermionic simulation aspect of these systems with measurement and gates? Because this would allow you to go beyond basic, say analog quantum simulation, which is, you know, sort of the domain of the cold atom community. They do it very well. Obvious kind of starting points are things like Heisenberg magnets that have filling or away from half filling Hubbard systems, and starting with small yet interesting demonstrations of what can be done just with three to four sites is the sort of like 1 year, 2 year horizon for the group. And so a question that you should ask is, why bother doing this? So an interesting idea is in the realm of this workshop is quantum matter. So going beyond traditional condensed matter probes of correlated systems, albeit small correlated systems for the moment, but being able to measure things like correlation functions directly using the spin readout, or just having, you know, more degrees of freedom to control our quantum system, like mixing this analog emulation with gates. And then another interesting area, not quite the topic of this workshop, well, there has been some bleeding into this area, is quantum computation. So avoiding errors in discretization in simulation tasks, or like a sort of a really interesting one is, if you have fermionic elements, the spinful fermions, could you get rid of the fermion to spin mappings that are responsible for a lot of overhead in conventional quantum simulations? So fermion to spin, these very expensive fermion to spin mappings that introduce overheads that are proportional to like some power in the system size, right? So one of the big barriers to doing this in a lab is that the system I talked about that has all these great properties, 99% fidelities on measurement and 2-qubit gates, is the electron spin in silicon. And this is the one that's isotope purified silicon 28. And the trouble is that, nature just doesn't give us everything for free. The electrons live in this conduction band. They're basically spin half particles, but they live in K space in these six equivalent momenta. And what actually happens as a consequence of that is that there's nearby states to our quantum states, our qubit states. So let's say this is my spin up here. This is my spin down. Then there's this small splitting, this valley orbit splitting, which it's, could be on the order of around 50 microeV. That's similar to our qubit energies and also similar to tunnel couplings that we're interested in. So this is sort of like a parasitic state in the Hilbert space. If you can also look at the single donor atom, which can, that's an impurity inside of a silicon host. There, the situation is a little bit different. You have a big valley orbit splitting, and that has to do with the details of, the central cell that causes this large splitting of the central cell of the impurity. But the bottom line is that this doesn't help you going to this type of system. So what you basically end up with is extra states in your Hilbert space, randomized tunnel couplings between individual sites. This randomized coupling comes from interference processes in tunneling from one site to another that arise because of these superpositions of valleys. In fact, this experiment directly visualizes those interference processes. And the main issue is that they're incommensurate with the lattice, because this conduction band minima is not all the way at the edge of the Brillouin zone. It's some fraction, 0.85 of the way in. So this ends up to be, you know, a major factor complicating our life if we want to use these kinds of qubits. And then another one, which is maybe worse, is the fact that the conduction band has a very large effective mass. And what that means is, in order to have large energy scales of confinement, in other words, if we go back here, if we want to have, let's say, large addition energy and large excited state splittings, the quantum dots need to be very, very small. And that pushes the limits of like what can be done with state of the art lithographic techniques. Okay. So it's not clear, you know, there are many challenges associated with building on this type of system. So the kind that I'm going to talk about is the whole spin qubits in the valence band. And I've been working on this topic for a while. So in a nutshell, one of the things that's very interesting about it is that we can keep many of the benefits of electrons. These are small devices, not quite as small. You see the length scale here is about 200 nanometers. The distance from one quantum dot to another is above 200 nanometers, whereas for electrons, it would be like 50 nanometers. And that really starts to get challenging. So that's one thing. A second is that long coherence times have been demonstrated, and I'll talk about that very briefly. And the other is that this design, the actual fabrication of this device, is very similar to the electron device. We can avoid weaknesses of the electron. So one of them is that the electron being in the conduction band as a spin 1/2, it experiences a relatively small spin orbit coupling, and then we can't drive it electrically. We can't manipulate it electrically. But these whole qubits, because it's a J=3/2 system, they have quadrupoles. There's my connection to the Young Beck's talk. We both have quadrupoles. So these qubits can be manipulated electrically once the Zeeman interaction breaks time reversal symmetry. So they can be driven electrically, and they don't have these valleys. Another aspect which is important is the mass is very light. That comes just a property of the band and allows these devices to be bigger. Then a rather sort of interesting result that we have published around a year ago was that in spite of being able to drive them electrically, they can be actually exceptionally coherent, similar to electrons. We demonstrated 10 millisecond coherence times. And that's not trivial, because in this system, neither spin nor charge is quantized. And typically, when we think about qubits, we think charge qubit is bad, spin qubit is good, because the spin is well hidden from the environment. But this qubit, it's J=3/2. So it's neither a spin nor a charge. It has, you know, this combination of spin up with PXI, PY, and spin down with PZ orbitals. So that was the first demonstration, in fact, and we had around orders of magnitude improvement over the best previous work, that the coherence time could, you know, really be in this millisecond regime. And the key there, just to give you the highlight, is that it comes from electric clock transition in the system. So not the analog of a magnetic clock transition in, say, like a cesium atom ion in vacuum. Okay. So this is the system that we're talking about. So let me give you now roughly the outline. I'm going to show you a few different results from my lab. This one we've been working on for around 2 years. And it's a process and demonstration that we can control charge tunnel coupling on-site interactions in small arrays of germanium-based quantum dots that host individual hole spins. So it will have a basic process of a single quantum dot, and we'll talk about quantum dot molecules and occupation and tunneling control. Then the next step is, I told you that the readout of these qubits, spin qubits, should be, is done with elements that are similar to superconducting technologies. And what I'm going to show you here is a new kind of superconducting electronics, a nonlinear electronics for readout. So it's a quantum optics based device in which parametric amplification can be done in a lossless way, even at very high magnetic fields, up to like 3 Tesla. And that's the range of magnetic fields needed for spin qubits. And I'll show you, yes, there are types of devices that can survive these high magnetic fields. I'll tell you why. And that these are phase sensitive and phase insensitive amplifiers that we've demonstrated. And then the last, which I'll very quickly kind of brush over, is computer aided design of these type of qubits, because the theory of these qubits, which I've actually been involved in developing, has been done in the early days in a way that didn't really take into account the design of the devices. And, you know, we asked the question, okay, what happens if you take into account the design of the devices? What phenomena survive, like the clock transition? How will things work when we consider that it's a real device? So let's first talk about the germanium quantum dot devices. So this is what the materials look like. It's a silicon substrate. And then on top of it, we grow a thick layer of germanium and some graded buffer layers. Then finally, we get to this strange germanium quantum well. It's a quasi two-dimensional system. And in the band structure, you get a combination of the heavy holes and light holes closely spaced to each other. And the ground state is mostly like a heavy hole. So it's JZ equals 3/2. That's a JZ equals 3/2 system. And the great thing that I just want to emphasize again is that the small effective mass, allowing us the devices to be a bit bigger, easier to control. This is a quasi two-dimensional system with strong spin orbit coupling that comes from coupling between 3/2 and 1/2 bands. And we can exploit this to manipulate the system. And then, we don't have this degeneracy problem because these bands are at the gamma point, right? So their maxima are at the gamma point. So long length scale perturbations can massively split those bands. This is what the device looks like. So this device here was fabricated by my postdoc, Abraham, and Glazer, a PhD candidate that works with me. And the idea is basically this. We have these plunger gate, then we apply a voltage and we accumulate a single hole underneath it. And then we have these accumulation gates that allows us to make a cold reservoir from which we bring this hole into the device. And then these green barrier gates, which allow us to kind of isolate this hole from the leads, from the reservoirs. And so the device, the actual fabrication of these devices, they require extremely clean and very high quality interfaces. These devices were fabricated at UBC. They're very quiet. And that's the reason why we use this type of materials, germanium silicon, is that we have a knowledge of how to do these, build these devices so that they're extremely quiet electrically. If there's a lot of electrical noise in the system, like from fluctuating charges and traps and so on, the electron number in here may fluctuate, or the tunnel coupling may fluctuate. So this is the key thing, is to make these very quiet devices, which we're now able to do in the UBC clean room. And they consist of these ohmic contacts, which allow us to populate the reservoirs. There's a gate dielectric here, and that is what electrically separates the gates that we apply voltage to from the quantum well. We have these top gates that we actually apply the voltages to induce the single holes and the reservoirs. And we have these large bond pads that allow us to come in with wire bonds to control these devices. And so this length scale down here is around 200 nanometers. And then this is sort of a zoom out of the device showing the accumulation for the omics. And so this device in particular is a simplified device architecture compared to the previous work on germanium, because it only has a single layer of gates. There's not gates overlapping on top of each other, which makes it much easier to fabricate, but it requires more fine control of the lithography to make smaller features and the accumulated reservoir. And so the question is, with this modification of the process to trade complexity for fine features, do we get control down to the last hole? The most basic question you'd ask is, can I control the number of holes? Can I control the tunnel coupling between holes? And, you know, can I control the energetics of the holes with this simplified process? And that's why I'm going to show you that that's indeed the case. So this measurement here is a measurement of current flowing through this device from this reservoir to this one. And it occurs through individual quantized levels on this island. And the smoking gun of this is the so-called Coulomb oscillations in the data. That's a current as a response to voltage on this plunger gate. And these peaks of current, where they come from, is they come from the at points where the n plus one particle state is degenerate with the n electron state. And that allows elastic tunneling through this device. And there's a cartoon of that here, but it's probably not worth going through. So some basic results on this are things like, you know, if we vary the bias from the across these two leads and also vary this plunger bias, we can deduce the on-site addition energy in our like effective Hubbard model for these devices. And you know, in the simplest case of one quantum dot, all you have is, you know, the addition energy, the U. And we get around 1.5 milliEV for this device. It comes from looking at the intersection of the N and N plus one lines. So really, if I draw it here, it comes from these two lines. And then you go over on the horizontal axis, this is around 1.5 milliEV. Then we can look at the coupling of this energy level inside of the quantum dot to this gate here. When we apply a voltage, how much does the energy level move? So it turns out that, you know, the energy level moves by a smaller amount than the voltage you apply to this gate. And that's because this gate induces charges on other gates in the system. And it's around 0.3 in this case. So, you know, for every 1 volt I apply on the gate, I can move the energy level by 0.3 volts in the quantum dot. Another interesting thing that we learn by looking at how these lines, the Coulomb oscillations, shift as a function of, say, barrier voltage here, the voltage applied here, and the plunger voltage applied here, we can see that when we apply a voltage to this barrier, we're moving the quantum dot energy level a bit. That's what this slope tells us. The lines are not vertical, but that's also a typical kind of value. So we moved on from this to building a device with 3 quantum dots. And here is the measurement on the right-hand side. This is the device on the left-hand side. And what we're measuring in this case is the current flowing through this series combination of this double quantum dot. The purple sort of like nearly horizontal lines correspond to loading this left plunger because they couple stronger to the plunger on the left. And then the more vertical lines are correspond to charging the quantum dot on the right. What we can see is an electrostatic repulsion between the two quantum dots. So the charge, in other words, the charge on this quantum dot feels the charge on this one, just as it would in the extended Hubbard model. And how we can tell that is that the lines here, you can see they break. This is not a straight line. It has these breaks in it. And that's our simple electrostatic repulsion. Then the next thing we see is tunnel coupling. And how do we see that? Well, we see that there starts to be a curvature to these lines. There's an avoided, basically there's an avoided crossing, and the curvature becomes so strong here that the lines are almost diagonal instead of being this, say, honeycomb shape as we get here. And that's a sign of the tunnel coupling. This, the two sites in this regime where the lines become almost straight is like a quantum dot molecule. It's a system like this, strongly tunnel coupled. And of course, we can control the number of particles on that as we move in this stability diagram. And so the last thing that we've recently shown, and this was just shown in September, was that we can have the charge sensor working. And that's important for the spin readout. I mentioned that if you want to know the spin of these two particles or one of them, then we need to do a spin to charge conversion. And the sensor for that charge is this single electron transistor at the bottom. So here we have a single electron transistor based quantum dot. These green lines here are the Coulomb oscillations for tunneling from through this single electron transistor. And then the lines, you can see that they break. There are breaks in the lines here, here, and here, and also here. The lines actually move like this, and that's the shift in those lines is the loading of this left quantum dot here, because they're strongly coupled to this left plunger. So what we've shown here is also the ability to completely empty this left quantum dot. And that's because we don't see any more breaks in these lines, these charge sensing lines. And so this is essentially like the full set of capabilities that we need from the device in order to do just control over the fermionic analog Hamiltonian. And in addition to that, by applying microwave onto these gates, we can electrically control qubits and electrically perform two-qubit gates. So that's what's in the horizon for us now that these devices are working. So yeah, as a sort of a summary, we can control a single hole at a time in one of these three quantum dots through their on-site Coulomb repulsion. And we do it using a gate voltage. We just adjust the voltage here. We can control quantum dots that are beside each other, right? It doesn't just apply for one quantum dot. We can get and fit many quantum dots into this picture. And we can control the charge down to the last hole as verified by this charge sensor. We can control the tunnel couplings. And in fact, by adjusting voltages on the barriers, we can tune them. And we can, it's very easy to resolve that these are, there are nearest neighbor Coulomb interactions. So the things that we're working on right now are devices that look like this to demonstrate the fast spin readout in the simulator, and working on triple quantum dot plus charge sensor, because that's, one of the smallest systems you can work on in which you can see in some interesting quantum mechanical phenomena. So like, for example, that's a frustrated system at half filling, and then away from half filling, you get this interesting triplet ground state, and so if you were able to tile this, you would be able to, it turns out you would be able to build an AKLT, like a spin one chain, basically, out of this, which has some interesting properties, right, like the spin half edge states. The other thing, of course, that we can do to these is drive them dynamically. So these are experiments on our horizon with the sort of capabilities we've demonstrated. So I want to shift a little bit gears to show you another thing that my group works on, which is microwave quantum optics. So and the specific result I'm going to show you is relevant to quantum dots. So it turns out that if you have a qubit and you want to read it out, then you need, it's probably not surprising that you need a very good amplifier to do that, right? Yeah, the qubit, the signal that's interrogating the qubit is pretty small. You don't want to like hit the qubit with a hammer. So you have a very small signal. It, you know, it might be like, okay, the number might be like around minus 130 dBm. So that means like around a femtowatt, roughly, very small power. So that signal needs to be amplified. And we need to look at its in phase and its amplitude to determine the qubit state. And that's usually done with something called a quantum limited amplifier. And the function is to amplify a signal related to the readout of the qubit and adding the smallest amount of noise that's allowed by quantum mechanics. And the way this typically is done in the superconducting qubit field is you by employing the nonlinearity of the Josephson junction, right? This is a system that has a, it's essentially a highly nonlinear inductor. And that nonlinearity allows you to do three-wave or four-wave mixing, depending on the details of the device. But the problem is that these devices cannot even handle like a millitesla magnetic field because the critical currents are very small and this just destroys the Josephson junction. So our approach is very different. We need large magnetic fields. We need to split our qubit states. We need something like a few tesla to do this. So we've instead turned to a kinetic inductance nanowire. That's an element, a nonlinear element, circuit element. Very little is, basically nothing was known about their application in nonlinear devices. Some linear work has been done. So for example, high quality factors could be obtained in high magnetic field. And the mechanism for that is this small cross section of this nanowire. It is 10 nanometer by say 100 nanometer, that's the cross section. And then the size of a vortex is actually, you know, if you have the magnetic field in the plane, this is actually smaller than the size of a vortex. So it massively suppresses loss due to vortices formation in these nanowires. And then the material itself needs to be a disordered material so that you get like this effective Josephson energy out of the system. And it turns out to be related to an array, can be modeled as an array of Josephson junctions. So this nonlinearity in high magnetic field was basically totally unexplored. So we built a parametric amplifier with the system and characterized it. So how that works is you have a signal coming in here and a pump also coming in. And then at the output, you have, let's say, G times Vs plus some noise. Let's call that Vn. And we looked at this, the conversion of this pump to the signal to amplify our input signal. And we looked at that as a function of magnetic field. This is what the setup looks like. So, you know, you have a signal generator and a generator for the pump. Then you have your device at 8 millikelvin. It's isolated from thermal radiation using attenuators and circulators, the usual superconducting electronics type setup. The nanowire we used is 10 nanometer thick, 100 nanometer wide. And in this regime, the inductance of the device is dominated by the kinetic inductance. So in other words, the kinetic energy of the Cooper pairs, right? The kinetic energy of the Cooper pairs goes like 1/2 LKI squared. And then the energy stored in the B field, the magnetic field, will be 1/2 LMI squared. This one dominates for this small diameter. In other words, the Cooper pairs need to go very fast because it's a small cross section. So that the energy, the dominant energy stored from the current is actually kinetic energy. It's not energy stored in the magnetic field. It's much bigger, like kinetic inductance, than the magnetic inductance. So how our device works, the effective Hamiltonian, is this four-wave mixing, Hamiltonian ride, linear harmonic oscillator, self-Kerr shift, and cross-Kerr. The cross-Kerr, we use this for converting the pump into the signal. And we measured this at 8 millikelvin. And I'll just give you the highlights. Yes.
Could you try to wrap up like in 2 or 3 minutes?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I'm almost there. So as a function of pump power, we can see the resonance frequency shifting. That's the self-Kerr effect. We can characterize the coefficients, and we can look at how they depend on magnetic field. So those coefficients don't have a strong dependence on magnetic field. And we can also demonstrate a phase-sensitive gain. So we could get up to 17 dB of amplification at an optimally chosen pump power. And that pump power is actually lower when the magnetic field is on, because the losses actually go down in that case. And the more latest devices have around 30 dB of amplification. And that allows us to see that the input referred noise is half a photon, like the smallest amount that's allowed. And so the key message here is that nonlinearity is highly robust to magnetic field for the spin qubit devices, and we have no degradation of SNR. I didn't show that in this figure, but we have, I didn't show that on this slide, but we have shown that in the preprint. I'll skip this, the qubit CAD, and just wrap up and say thanks to my team at UBC and theory collaborators and the collaborators who gave the materials for the devices. And thank you for your attention.
So we have time for a few questions. So maybe
happy to take your questions.
Yeah, so maybe let me start. So very naive question. So what's the major challenges for like scaling up the system size in your system?
So yeah, that's a great question. So I would say that for scaling up the quantum dot platform, one of the biggest challenges is that the ability to we have very long coherence times and few qubit devices and good manipulation fidelities, but those don't always translate into larger devices, because to get the control over the larger devices, you need to like a little bit more expose them to decoherence. So that is going to be a challenge as devices scale up. Invariably, fidelities will go down. And we'll have to understand the mechanisms limiting those fidelities and modify the system accordingly. I think, one of the main challenge, another challenge I would want to highlight, but I don't know if it really fits into your question, is how do you even use a fermionic quantum computer? You know, algorithms are not designed for spinful fermions. They're designed for spins, usually. What you can actually do with that, I think, is a bit of an open question, but it's an interesting one because now we can make this system exist. And then I think we would have, like, because the devices are small, we need to maintain yield as we scale them up. So that's that will be a challenge. And then also, you know, as they scale up again, just calibrating the system, like getting control over like a 10 qubit system, you need to write some code that will like automatically tune the system into kind of like a state where it can be used. That's another kind of generic kind of challenge. But I think the most specific challenge is, you know, understanding non-idealities of this system as it's scaled, mechanisms of decoherence. I mean, the answer is always decoherence, I think, when you talk about scaling.
I see. Yeah, thanks. Any other question? Yeah.
You were talking about hybrid computation through measurement and gates. Could you extend a little bit on which kind of measurements can you do on-site to qubit?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, so so the generally on measurement, the simplest thing for us to do is measure in the singlet triplet basis. So like we can learn correlation between of two spins that are adjacent to each other pretty easily, because that's the native way that the measurement works in a spin-based quantum computer. And but of course, like with ancilla qubits, we can measure in the single qubit subspace. That's also available to us with a little bit more effort. And then in terms of dynamics, it's the usual dynamics. So say, you know, single qubit gates, controlled rotations. And when I think of hybrid digital analog, I'm thinking about some kind of unitary evolution that's, you know, more complex than two qubit gates, involving interactions between qubits. Say, and then the simplest example of that hybrid could be something like, okay, I do some analog dynamics and then I do density matrix tomography on it. I need qubit rotations and projective measurements.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Joe. I was wondering how hard it would be to use like multiple orbitals on one of these dots in like a controlled way to enlarge your Hilbert space.
That's a really great question. So I think it's basically an open question, and I'll tell you what I think the challenge is. So the energy, like one thing that I would be concerned about by going to higher orbitals, let's say I make my quantum dot like an ellipse so that I get like a low-lying px orbital or something. I would be worried about electric noise coupling into that system and like introducing purity phasing because of the dipole moment of S to P, for example. So if the system could be well enough isolated from electric noise, I think that could be doable. And one of the, I would say, like one of the advantages of this system in terms of isolation from electric noise is that everything is epitaxial in the device. So there, it's not like a superconducting qubit that has a glass with full of two-level systems. You know, in a Josephson, a superconducting-based qubit, you have the sapphire substrate, it's full of two-level systems, then the qubit couples to those. And those two-level systems are there because it's a glass. And this system doesn't have a glass in it. It's epitaxial. You can go all epitaxial. So single crystal. Hetero interfaces. Yeah, it's a very interesting question.
Okay, so we are running late. So here and thank you.